This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. As the real estate market soars here in Chattanooga, one possible solution to the lack of affordable housing, especially downtown, is a community land trust. It's a model that would help people with low to moderate incomes buy into affordable housing. And now, a report details how that model could work citywide. The feasibility study by the nonprofit CALEB, Chattanoogans in Action for Love, Equality, and Benevolence, was funded by the City of Chattanooga, and the consultancy firm Burlington Associates in Community Development was contracted to assist CALEB with the study. Michael Gilliland is CALEB's organizing director, and Austin Sauerbrei is co-chair of its Economic Mobility Task Force. Michael, Austin, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Remind folks what community land trusts are.
The Community Land Trust is a community-based organization that's established to serve as a long-term steward of land. And that could be in a given neighborhood or a city or a region. And basically what that means in practicality is that a land trust either buys or receives donated land and acquires new homes, and then it makes those homes available to sale for limited income homeowners. So folks who may not have had the opportunity to be a homeowner, and they write down the purchase price to an affordable level that can be done through the use of public and private subsidies. But the thing that makes a community land trust unique is that it functions as a long-term steward of land. And so the CLT actually maintains ownership of the land through a long-term lease agreement with the new homeowner. And then that homeowner actually maintains ownership of the home. But whenever that homeowner goes to sell the home, whenever they're ready to move, they're able to build equity in that home for as long as they decide to live there. But when they sell it, they have to pass on the affordability to the next homeowner.
So this is designed to prevent things such as speculation.
Absolutely. Sort of the three things that the land trust model really gets at is it serves as a long-term shield against speculative investment. So it prevents these large investment companies from coming in and buying a property, flipping it, and then selling it at double the price 2 years later. So it makes sure that the community has a hand in the long-term stewardship of the land. And then second, it decreases the barrier to entry for first-time limited income homeowners. So we're actually creating entryways and pathways to homeownerships for folks who might not otherwise be able to. And then finally, it's really one of the most efficient uses of public and private subsidies, because that initial subsidy that's helping that homeowner get into that home is passed along every time that property is sold. So it's a way to maintain long-term permanent affordability for housing.
Where have we seen this work elsewhere in the country?
There are nearly 300 community land trusts around the country. The proven model, the oldest one, goes back over 50 years. So you see really thriving, successful examples around Boston, Vermont, places around the country, but it's not just relegated to those areas. We have community land trust examples here in the South. In fact, in Albany, Georgia, we have the oldest running community land trust in the country. Durham, North Carolina is another great example. They have over 300 units of affordable homes in their portfolio. They've been around since 1987, and they're showing it that it works for a city of our size with similar burdens and difficulties.
And what gaps does this model fill that neither the market nor other existing programs for affordable housing for people of limited income can do?
One of the great things about the CLT model is that it balances the interests of prospective homeowners with the long-term interests of the community and making sure that we have a housing stock that is affordable. So the benefit is through the use of the long-term stewardship model, we're able to support through public subsidy an investment for homeowners to be able to achieve housing stability, to have their own home, to be building equity for themselves, while at the same time, those lease agreements ensure that if they choose and as they move on in their lives, that they sell the property, that they can't be flipped. They can't all of a sudden skyrocket up, well, up to the market price of beyond the means of other working class families. So what this does that other models don't do is, number one, it allows for equity to be built while you have a long-term relationship built with the community land trust. The community land trust has an incentive and support for the homeowners.
How do you propose to bring this model here and make it work?
Our recommendations are recommendations specifically for the city of Chattanooga. It's a push to have the city invest in the model. And this is something that meets the need. It especially meets the need now with Chattanooga being listed on multiple reports as one of the hottest housing markets in the country. We need some way, and it's in the city's interest, to be able to address the affordability gap between what the current and continuing rise in housing cost is, between what people can afford. We are looking for the city to commit to the model, to commit to funding the model long-term over a five-year plan, to provide adequate public support investment to make sure that the model comes up to scale. We're also asking that the city really consider a dedicated funding stream for affordable housing. There are many needs in the housing front for Chattanooga. This fills some of them, but it definitely doesn't fill all of them. Things like affordable housing rentals, eviction relief. So what we were proposing is that the community land trust become part of a broader comprehensive housing plan for the city, and that has dedicated funding allocated to it. The last thing that we're asking is that the community land trust, if is given support by the city, that it becomes a preferred option for the use of public subsidy. So wherever possible, we're looking for public subsidy going towards affordable housing to be invested in the community land trust so that we can make sure that that investment is really reinforcing permanent affordability.
When we talk about a subsidy from the city, how much are we talking about? How many families potentially would be helped by this? Over how long?
So if folks go online, you can see our full report with the detailed model budget. What we're proposing is that over the course of the first 5 years, that the city could invest $5 million. And with that $5 million in investment, that would produce 110 community land trust homes. But as we talked about earlier, the real benefit of the land trust model is that affordability is passed on every time that home is sold. So over 30 years, we're estimating that that $5 million investment would create 330 new limited income homeowners.
And then how much of a responsibility would this model in action put on either an organization such as Caleb or the city as a de facto landlord?
Well, I think there is clarity here that with the land trust model, the homeowner owns their home, just like they would buy on the market. They own their home. The role that the land trust has is really has to do with the resale formula whenever someone decides to sell the property. So the land trust would not be in the business of being a landlord per se. The community land trust would be in the business of making sure that the community has a long-term interest and investment in what happens to those properties and making sure the affordability gets passed on.
One of the things that this comes down to is supply and demand, given the condition of the economy here in Chattanooga and the condition of the real estate market.
It's not keeping up. I mean, every month last year, in the midst of the pandemic, we've seen a decrease in Chattanooga's housing stock. It's not keeping up with the demand. The expectation is between now and 2030 that 42,000 more people will be moving into Hamilton County, right? And so we need to find some way, considering there's only so much land. We need to find some way that there is land that's put aside for public purpose to make sure that working class Chattanoogans have an opportunity for home ownership.
I think just to reiterate a point that Michael stated earlier, when we're talking about the use of public subsidy in this moment right now, knowing that the affordability gap is only going to be widening 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. So if we're looking at investing money now, we need to make sure that that subsidy is actually going to be a permanent subsidy that's going to maintain affordability in the long term. Most of the models that are in existence right now do a great job of helping individuals, helping get a single homeowner into a new home. But as soon as that homeowner decides to sell the property, that subsidy benefit is gone. And so this model is attempting to make wiser use of our public investment to make sure that people are being taken care of in the long run.
And if people want more information about the report, where can they go online?
Well, they can find it on our website, www.calebcha.org/CLT study. We have both the executive summary and the full report that is available for download.
All right. Michael, Austin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Every few years, we hear about a new superfood, dense with nutrients, that is supposed to be super good for our health. Quinoa, blueberries, almonds, kale, and acai have all had their time in the superfood spotlight. Whatever the real health benefits these foods provide, there is also a boom and bust cycle to the buzz. A new series of essays from researchers in various disciplines around the world examines the political, economic, and social effects. Emma McDonnell is co-editor of Critical Approaches to Superfoods, along with Robert Wilk, and she is a visiting professor of anthropology on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ray.
Tell us more about Critical Approaches to Superfoods. It's a collection of essays.
It's a collection of research essays. So all of these essays are based in social science or humanities research. So some of the folks in the volume are historians, some are anthropologists like myself, a couple are geographers. So it's an eclectic mix of perspectives on superfoods. And what motivated this book was effectively realizing that so much of the academic and really non-academic conversations about superfoods tend to create this binary where superfoods are either framed as panaceas, these sort of cure-alls, and the research or the conversation is centered on validating their powers, or on the other hand, they're framed as shams. So they're ineffective at best, or they're swindles at worst. And so this book is really about getting beyond these questions of the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of superfoods. And so we're not critical in the sense of saying superfoods are mere marketing devices to get people to buy things they don't need. You know, in this model, customers are sort of dupes that marketing agencies can easily convince to purchase things because of their kind of willingness to buy anything that they think might be able to help them health-wise or cure some sort of ailment. So we're really trying to move beyond that conversation and shift the focus away from the question of efficacy to ask about what kinds of work superfoods do in the world and how they acquire value and power, how their economic value and perceived power increases, and also how they lose power. So historically, there have been a number of superfoods that have then lost their perceived power as superfoods. And this is one of our findings, that superfoods tend to move in sort of boom-bust cycles, where a superfood comes to have a huge amount of perceived symbolic power. Often this is a moment of kind of hype, as we might discuss it. And then with time, it starts to lose its power. And so there are different ways that superfoods lose their power. But we see this pattern again and again, where foods come to attract a huge amount of attention from consumers or from other populations too, for their potential as cure-alls or panaceas. But then slowly but surely, they lose that symbolic power. So we're really shifting away from this question of efficacy, because ultimately, whether or not a food truly cures bodily ailments or unlocks untapped stores of energy, which is a common kind of story told about a superfood, is that they will unlock this energy that's inside you that without this superfood, you don't have access to. Whether or not these things are true in a kind of measurable biological sense, the story of superfoods and popular beliefs in them have really important and often dramatic effects on society, on politics, on the economy. And so really, this is what we're interested in when I talk about critical approaches to superfoods, is what kinds of social work they're doing, what types of cultural and economic and even political work do superfoods do, with superfoods as this kind of perception of foods as having incredible hours.
Talk about quinoa as an example of this.
My own research is on the quinoa boom and bust in Peru. And so I've done 18 months of ethnographic field work, interviewing and conducting participant observation. So effectively kind of deep hanging out with quinoa farmers in the Puno region of Peru. So that's up along the shores of Lake Titicaca. And not just farmers, also other commodity chain actors. So my contribution to this volume is both as an editor who kind of organized the workshop and the book that resulted from it, along with writing the introduction. But my own chapter in the volume is about the history of beliefs in quinoa as a superfood, and not just a superfood for consumers. So most of us are familiar with quinoa as a consumer superfood. So it's marketed as this high protein grain. It's often connected to the Inca Empire. But throughout much of the 20th century, quinoa was actually framed as a miracle crop, closely related to superfoods, a miracle crop for international development. So it was perceived as a food and crop that could help alleviate malnutrition globally. Increasingly, as climate change became more and more pressing, folks started to pitch quinoa as a climate change adaptation miracle crop. So quinoa, being native to the Andean highlands, it thrives at 12,000 to 13,000 feet of altitude in really arid climates. And so increasingly, quinoa became pitched as this global climate change adaptation crop. So there's efforts to expand quinoa production into sub-Saharan Africa, parts of India, various arid, drought-prone climates that are increasingly facing more and more frequent droughts. And so my own contribution is about the various stories being told about quinoa's potential. And one of the most interesting things about this is the way that these stories come into conflict. And yet people seem to sort of ignore those moments of tension or conflict. So for instance, in the Andean highlands, quinoa is pitched as a poverty alleviation tool. And that's with respect to export markets. So if quinoa prices are high, and consumers, wealthy consumers across the globe are buying quinoa, well, these Andean farmers who have few income opportunities, many have someone at the mine, like a nearby mine, others have small informal jobs, but there's very few stable economic opportunities in these areas. So quinoa export is perceived as this poverty alleviation tool. Now that one of our local crops, there's very few crops you can grow in this region, has international acclaim, well, this is a sustainable development tool. That's how it's pitched. At the very same time, quinoa is pitched as a malnutrition alleviation tool in Peru and in the Andes more broadly. But there's a conflict there, because if quinoa's price is high, that's great for farmers. They're sending their kids to college. They've never been able to do that before. They're buying motorcycles to get to town. Their lives are really changed by this high price. But if quinoa's price is high, then the urban poor in Peru and other parts of the Andes too, so in Bolivia's La Paz and other cities, quinoa has been a staple for the urban poor who are not farming quinoa. And if quinoa's price is high, they can't afford it. And so they have to replace quinoa in their diets with other starchy staples. So most commonly sort of instant noodles, sort of like ramen noodles. So that's one of the contradictions that I find in these different stories about quinoa's sort of miracle crop or superfood potential.
And these boom and bust cycles can roil and rearrange relations, not only for producers, but also consumers.
Absolutely. These boom bust cycles, we tend to think in terms of effects of a boom bust in terms of production, like you say. So we tend to think of the impacts on farmers. But really, one of the most pressing negative impacts of the quinoa boom was on Peruvian consumers. And there was actually a lot of media attention in about 2012 through 2014, which was really the height of the quinoa boom, about this. But what those stories got wrong was that they talked about quinoa farmers no longer eating quinoa. But that wasn't really the problem. Farmers continued to eat quinoa throughout this. It was those urban poor who could not pay $6 per kilo for quinoa, which used to be 25, 30 cents a kilo.
And we see these kinds of ripple effects, whether we're talking about quinoa one year, kale another year, pomegranate the year after that. And then there's an example from California, where you're from Northern California. I'm thinking about almonds, which are water intensive, and away that the industry saw to push back against the pushback was to rebrand itself as a superfood.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a really interesting story. So Emily Reisman, the author of this piece, has analyzed the history of marketing campaigns in California's very powerful almond industry. And effectively, they were facing a problem of overproduction, and consumers were kind of tepid about almonds in the 90s and into the early 2000s. And so the almond industry folks kind of came together and said, well, what are we going to do? They kind of see almonds as boring, unremarkable nuts. And, you know, people see them as things that go in a mix of nut cocktails, you know, and they had kind of this surplus of nuts as so many producers had continued to invest in almond production, even as you say, they're facing constant drought in Northern California. And so they rebrand almonds really successfully as superfoods. And, you know, at this point, almonds are considered by many to be this kind of ideal snack, a handful of almonds, it's rich in protein and good fats and things like that. And they were really successful in kind of turning around the almond industry and building this concept of almonds as these kind of uniquely powerful nuts.
You've talked about these inherent tensions when these waves of boom and bust cycle through from superfood to superfood. That's a tension that's always with us, the desire for healthier living and the unseen costs in another part of the world to make that happen for us in a place like California or Chattanooga.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's something I'm deeply concerned about, that I think that there's, on the one hand, a positive impetus for people to change their diets in ways that increase longevity and kind of day-to-day health and happiness. And I think that that's a good thing. I'm deeply concerned, though, about the ways that sometimes our interest in kind of novelty and this sort of constant need for the new can have pretty devastating impacts on local economies. So certainly in the case that is most intimate to me, the quinoa boom and bust, that had dramatic impacts on local livelihoods, not all positive. And so I think there is a bit of a distinction between just kind of desire for health and healthy foods and having a balanced diet and the kind of constant pursuit of novelty. And I think there's an interesting way that health food markets and our kind of consumerist desires for novelty, the kind of positive feeling in our brain when we try something new. And I think that there's an interesting way that our, you know, desires around health get mixed in with our not always so healthy kind of consumerist constant pursuit of more, 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 new, new, new. So yeah, I don't think that superfoods are sort of a bad thing, and it's not a bad thing to eat some of these foods, but I do think it's important for us to consider the way that the constant kind of novelty factor creates really dramatic and rapid changes across the world in these local economies, and they're often fleeting benefits. So these booms and busts, right? Folks in the context of the quinoa boom in Peru, you know, these farmers were able to make real changes in their lives temporarily, right? But when the quinoa boom busted and prices fell in 2015 and they've never gotten back up, that's a short-lived benefit. So I think there's a question of sustainability. Yeah, that tension between people's desires for health and the impacts of that are something I'm really interested in.
And if people want to keep up on your work online, where can they go?
They could go to my faculty profile at UTC. So I'm in the Social, Cultural, and Justice Studies department. So under the faculty profiles. Another place is I do have a personal website where I post updates of my research. It's emmamcdonnell.com. My last name spelled a little funny. It's MCDONELL.
All right. Emma, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me here.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. The greater demand for blood donations in this area has been a constant during the past year of the pandemic, and now is no exception. Caitlin Stanley is with Blood Assurance.
Caitlin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the need at this time at Blood Assurance.
We are in a very critical need situation. O positive and O negative, which are the most common in the universal blood type, are in very critical need. We are sitting at less than half a day's supply. So it's very important that the community comes out and donates. Right now, you know, we really do not have enough blood on the shelf if there were to be a major accident, or we are sitting right in the middle of tornado season. We've seen a lot of scary weather reports. So we really want to make sure everyone understands that it's the blood that's already on the shelf that goes to help these patients in need. So we really need to be stocked up before anything were to happen.
And how does the need now compare to the last time we spoke a few months ago or late last year? This has been a chronic problem all through the pandemic.
It really has. Probably about a year ago, right when the pandemic started, hospitals were canceling elective surgeries and people were quarantining and staying home. And so the need actually wasn't as great, but things are getting back to normal, if not already completely back to normal as far as surgeries and hospital and traumas go. So that's why I think we're seeing such a big increase in the need right now.
And of course, Blood Assurance serves not only Chattanooga and the immediate area, but far beyond that.
We have centers and we serve hospitals all the way down to Georgia, all the way down to Cartersville, as well as in Middle Tennessee. We actually just opened up a new center in Clarksville. So we serve several major hospitals throughout Middle Tennessee, Eastern Tennessee, and Georgia, and into Kentucky as well.
And that brings us to what you are calling donor madness.
Yes, that's right. We're so excited about it. It's something brand new, something different that we've never done before, really to highlight the importance of blood donations, but also to celebrate our donors. We have donors that give every time they're eligible. Then we have donors that give once a year, you know, whatever the issue is, whatever, how often we can see you. We just want to celebrate you and thank you for being loyal Blood Assurance lifesavers. So we're doing really fun prizes. We're giving away Starbucks gift cards. We are giving away hourly giveaways to Academy Sports for $50. March 30th through the end of Donor Madness, which ends on April 5th, we are doing 15 $500 Topgolf gift cards. So as we all know, Topgolf is a lot of fun and something that's really popular right now. And so we're so excited to partner with them to be able to offer 15 of our donors these $500 gift cards. It's really exciting. Not only are you saving three lives, but you have the option of winning something. And it's part of a Commit to Give series. So four times a year, we're going to do these events. And if you donate at each of these events throughout the year, then you're entered to win a vacation to Gulf Shores. So lots of fun things, lots of exciting giveaways. And for more information, you can check out our website, bloodassurance.org.
All right. Caitlin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Time for a host-to-host conversation about our Sounds of the Southeast, the shows from our public radio neighbors about the places we call home, heard weekends here on WUTC. Dave Higgs is the host of Bluegrass Breakdown, which comes to us from WPLN in Nashville, airing Sunday nights at 11 p.m. here on WUTC. He spoke to us from his home studio in Cullioca, Tennessee.
Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
And glad to have you on WUTC with Bluegrass Breakdown.
Well, you know, Chattanooga has been an important part in the history of bluegrass, and I'm just glad that you're allowing me to continue that down there in your neck of the woods.
Your relationship with bluegrass goes way back, an introduction to Flat and Scruggs.
My grandfather was a big bluegrass fan, and I had my first exposure to bluegrass sitting on his ottoman listening to the Flat and Scruggs show, and there was just something about it that I loved, and it resonated, and well, here I am.
When did radio come along? And then from there, to share bluegrass on the radio.
I was in my second year at Vanderbilt University, and my parents called me to the dinner table one evening and said, we've got to have a serious chat. I said, okay, cringing for the worst. And they announced to me in no uncertain terms, I needed to participate in at least one extracurricular activity that they didn't feel like they were getting their money's worth. So I thought about it a little bit and I tried to think of the least taxing endeavor I could engage in. And I thought, I know, I'll start a bluegrass show. So that's what I did. That's how I got started. And I kind of got hooked. And here I am 45 years later.
The show that you started there was the first bluegrass show at that station on that campus.
That is correct. Still going strong. Moved to Colorado to finish law school. And I started a bluegrass show out there on KGNU in Boulder. And then I took over Pete Wernick's radio show in Denver on KCFR, which he called Bluegrass Breakdown. Pete, of course, is a well-known banjo player, known as Dr. Banjo, and a founding member of Hot Rise. And so I took that over from him and kept it going all these years.
And in keeping it going all these years, you are steeped in bluegrass. You were a staff writer for Bluegrass Now magazine. You had a column in Bluegrass Now magazine. You play. Tell us about what you play.
Guitar is my main instrument, but I also play a little banjo and mandolin. You can't get into this music without jumping headfirst into it and trying to learn everything you can about it. So I was in a group for a while with my wife at the time, and I kind of got the performance aspect of bluegrass a little bit out of my system. It's a hard life and the pay's not good, but it's a wonderful thing to be able to do what you love, money or not.
Favorite performance that you were a part of?
Jonesboro, Tennessee. They had a big event on, I think it was Friday nights, where they'd close off all the streets around the courthouse and everybody would fill into the streets and you played on the steps of the courthouse. That was probably my favorite. It was just packed. It was a beautiful evening. We played well. And I thought, you know, I could die right now pretty happy.
What do you try to bring to Bluegrass Breakdown to make it unique week after week? There are so many bluegrass programs around, including and above all here in Tennessee.
Well, I try and let my somewhat bizarre, quirky, weird personality shine through. So I tend to be a little irreverent. My main goal is to entertain, but if I can educate and edify a little bit along the way, that's good. But I mainly just am myself, just try and have fun. I don't take myself too seriously. I take the music seriously, but I like having fun with it, getting around, keep it light, keep it moving, and not talk incessantly. That's what I think I'm doing anyway. We'll see.
Well, I hear what you're saying, just given a few of the recent shows that you have shared with us. One of them that comes to mind, actually, it was a two-part about hillbillies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a topic you could spend a year on, but you know, I just have ideas floating around on my head and then I try and get every song I can about that particular topic and just have fun with it. And generally you can sit down and it's kind of like a puzzle. You have to map things out because of time constraints, but generally I can find a narrative that I can fit the songs to and keep it moving, keep it flowing, and hopefully keep it interesting.
And another that comes to mind is the recent episode about jewels. How did you come up with that one?
Sometimes I just have ideas. I probably have 300 or 400 ideas written down. And jewels is a fun one because I had just enough songs for one show. If you chose a topic like cabins, you could have like literally a year's worth of shows on that subject. So sometimes I like to find a subject that I can encapsulate and present in one program. And I don't know how I came up with jewels, to be honest with you. Probably a song I heard and I thought, that would make a good topic.
How do you see the bluegrass scene today? You have been observing it for a long, long time.
It's very healthy, very vibrant. You have a lot of people that are keeping the tradition going. You have bands that are pushing the boundaries, and I think it is more widely accepted today than it ever has been. It's healthy. There's more participants. And I think bluegrass is never going to die. It's only going to get bigger and better. And it's, you know, a great time to be a bluegrass fan. And I remember back in the 70s or 60s even, I mean, it was really hard to find a bluegrass record. If a record came out in the bluegrass world, it was like cause for celebration, you know, lighting a bonfire and shooting off fireworks and whatnot, because it was just so rare. And now they come out daily. It's a great time. There's room for all of it. And there is all different facets of bluegrass being promulgated by various people.
And that includes room for experimentation. That includes room for the younger generations picking it up. That's always been a concern with bluegrass. Is it going to be passed down to the next generation?
Right. And there's been, you know, a lot of controversy about what is bluegrass. And I found that people generally fall into two camps. One camp is bluegrass is music that sounds like the stuff that Bill Monroe and Flatten Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers played in the 50s, and nothing else fits that mold. I happen to be of the second opinion, which is bluegrass is anything played with bluegrass instruments that even infinitesimally is comparable to the type of music that was played back in the 50s and 60s. So I have a much broader definition. But yeah, there's room for it all. And, you know, when you think about it, Bill Monroe was a huge rebel and an experimenter and completely broke the mold when he played in higher keys, sped things up, got new material. So basically, the experimenters of today are carrying on Bill's tradition. And to me, that's a big part of bluegrass is just keep pushing the boundaries. If it's good music, it's good.
How have you been doing the show during this pandemic? How's that affected you?
I've always done the show from home, so it hasn't affected me at all. I basically record it here at the house, and then I send it to the station on DVD data discs, and my producer, Scott Smith, weaves his magic, and he goes from there. We go from there, yeah.
In all the bluegrass that you have heard and seen over the years, which artists, which groups, which songs do you just find yourself coming back to for whatever reason?
That's kind of like asking me, you know, what is my favorite child? I love them all, but to actually answer your question, I'm attracted to, in the early days, I love Flatten Scruggs. The Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe are probably my three faves from the early days. And as time has gone on, I've loved bands like Hot Rise and The Seldom Scene. I don't have any particular incredible favorite right now. And my favorite sound are the ones that are in the Dorian or the Mixolydian modes, like Pretty Polly or Doing My Time, and just really kind of the ancient tones, as we call them, where the sometimes you just have one or two chords in the song and it just sounds really mountainy and old and sounds like something that a bunch of Anglo-Saxons would have stripped naked and danced around in the hills to. That's what I'm attracted to the most.
We got to end with a word picture, and you gave us a word picture.
Yeah.
If people want to keep up on the show beyond listening to it here on WUTC, where can they go online?
Bluegrassbreakdown.com. And they can also contact me with questions, whatnot, at bluegrass@wpln.org.
All right, Dave. Thanks so much.
Ray, thank you. I appreciate all you've done. And I had no idea what you had been doing. And I'm very grateful. Anytime.
And now, a sampling of Dave Higgs from a recent Bluegrass Breakdown.
On this week's Bluegrass Breakdown, it's old as dirt, as pure as the driven snow, more rollicking than an outhouse fly, and a lot more fun than anything ought to be. We'll be taking a long overdue and much needed look at recent old-timey tinge releases from the likes of the Horsenecks, Kurt Sutphin, Brad Lefwich and Linda Higginbotham, David Bragger and Susan Platts, Adam Hurt and the Twin Creek String Band. I'm Dave Higgs, and it'll be raw, intense, real, unfiltered, pre-bluegrass and exquisite. Coming up this old-time music, it's better than it sounds, edition of Bluegrass Breakdown. We'll begin our romp through old time land with a duo from Oregon, Gabrielle McCray and Barry Southern, the Horsenecks, singing the title to their Tiki Parlor recording, Started Out in Town. Brad Lefwich and Linda Higginbotham whooping it up with David Bragger at home in the Tiki Parlor with the Arkansas Hollerin' Tune. Well, howdy friends and neighbors, Dave Higgs here, welcoming you to Bluegrass Breakdown, where we'll be departing a bit from our norm and giddily jumping into the thrilling sounds of new old-time music. Old-time and bluegrass are inexorably intertwined, but there are differences, not only in the way the instruments are played, but in the way the music impacts the listener. For me, old-time has always stimulated my more primitive, primeval, hunter-gatherer side in a way that I find thrilling. Here's a group that has always delivered the old-time thrills in spades. Formerly known as the Dry Hill Draggers, this is the Twin Creek String Band from southwestern Virginia, the epicenter of old-timey-dom, with Pallet on Your Floor.
Listen to Dave Higgs and Bluegrass Breakdown weekends here on WUTC at 11 p.m. on Sunday nights. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.